Every day, we're confronted by pictures from our southern border. The fence crashing, the river crossings, by border-defying migrants illegally flooding into America. Today, we hear from one of the nation's foremost experts on illegal immigration and Mexico-U.S. relations, George Mason University professor Guadalupe Correa Cabrera. She lived on that southern border for years and collected real-life stories of triumph and tragedy. It's must reading for any policymaker serious about this danger to lives and homeland security. From Ballard Studios in Washington, D.C., it's 13th and Park.
We give you information, not a panic attack.
I mean, look what's going on. I mean, my God.
This was it. My kids were gonna die.
That time is gone forever.
This is the biggest story in America.
We weren't prepared for this.
Don't you want to speak truth to power?
Toughest thing I ever had to do.
Professor, great to have you on the show. Today I'm going to be your student. Treat me as someone that has a lot to learn. Let's start off with the paper you wrote 2 years ago for the Kennedy Institute, talking about the sophistication of these smuggling networks, the money behind them, the intel, the communications, suggesting that if we're going to start to really go after illegal immigration in this country, we've got to go to the source and not to the endpoint.
That is right. I lived 8 years in the city of Brownsville, Texas, you know, the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. The issue of immigration and undocumented immigration was a hot topic way back then. 2014, the unaccompanied minor crisis took place. And then I started to study this phenomenon on the ground. I was living there. And I was focusing on immigration after I started to study the criminal groups and the organizations that have diversified their activities and were starting to become involved in human smuggling. So I started to study human smuggling organizations. I thought they were businesses that, you know, people facilitated the mobility of others because the border started to be closed in 1994 around those years, Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line, and people started to take other routes.
Operation Hold the Line and Gatekeeper, those were considered fairly successful at that point, weren't they?
That's when things started to change. The networks facilitating human mobility started to move towards other routes. And then the Sonora-Arizona border, the desert, became an option for people that wanted to work in the United States because jobs were available in this country, have been available in this country. But the possibilities for the people to enter legally, legal pathways, started to become more rigid.
So you said the deserts became an option. In other words, they're going off-road to cross the American border?
Yes. This is where the smuggling network started to appear. Who can lead you through the desert? Who can facilitate that mobility? Operation Gatekeeper, Operation Hold the Line, Operation Rio Grande, that, you know, made people take more dangerous terrains with the help of others. And this is when some criminal organizations, some, not all, because this is also something that we need to understand, that human smuggling networks are not necessarily drug smuggling operations at the same time. But we saw that some of the people or the organizations that were trafficking drugs, that were smuggling drugs to the other side, were also getting involved in the business of people. So the lack of legal pathways, like the very unsuccessful immigration policy in this country where jobs were available, but there were no legal pathways, they were starting to close the border itself with these operations, started to make, you know, these organizations to grow. I'm talking about the smuggling operations, the smugglers, the so-called coyotes that started to be a family business and became much more sophisticated. And then the terrorist attack, September 11 came. Operation Gatekeeper and Hold the Line were just a small example. The Department of Homeland Security was created. The Border Fence Act took place. The construction of the fence, bringing mud boots on the ground, and the technology. So closing the border and the creation of the politics of fear, the building of the politics of fear to continue justifying the closing of the border when jobs were available. And people know that they are available. They just need to cross the checkpoint, not just the border, but the checkpoint.
Reception, Professor, right now is it's gotten a lot worse. That's the perception in America. Real or not, we're bombarded with pictures of, you know, the crossings. What has made it grow, it seems, exponentially as a problem that the American people are now seeing is not just a border problem.
Absolutely.
It's affecting every state, literally, in America.
Many things have happened in the past 2 decades. of course, the situation in the world has become worse. COVID-19 affected the economy. Different armed conflicts. We talk about the war in Ukraine, the big conflict in the Middle East, and poverty inequality around the world has become much worse. Those are the root causes of unauthorized immigration, undocumented immigration. And so that is one thing. But on the other thing, like also the differences, I mean, inequalities between the global north and the global south have also increased. Mm-hmm. And that has generated this need of those who are, you know, in need to give their lives, their families a better life, because there is a possibility. Jobs are available in the global north, but the legal pathways do not exist. And so what has happened is that what I have explained, this sophistication of the networks have become global. And the capacity of them, because this is a business, you start to charge a fee and you see that people see that and they are able to come to the United States. And people from every part of the world are trying to make it to the United States because the networks facilitate that mobility from the African continent, from the Middle East, from Ukraine and Russia. Just in 2022, we started to see a number of people by the end of the year from Russia and Ukraine. I mean, in Tijuana, at the Mexican border. And this becomes an issue for American citizens, right? People from China are coming right in big numbers. What we see, of course, it's covered with an intention, and sometimes it's political, but it's a reality. Many people trying to make it to the United States because of several things happening. More inequality, poverty, violence, armed conflict, climate change. Climate change is another factor that has been affecting different regions of the world.
Why is that? So jobs are drying up, literally, you know, in certain parts, and they say, we can't make it here.
Yes.
And so that's the reason climate change is the driver of this?
Absolutely. And this affects more poor people because they, for example, some of them live off agriculture. And so agriculture is not a possibility for them anymore. So they need to move somewhere else. And the availability of jobs, the main factor probably that explains this, pull and push factors. I was talking about push factors, but let's talk about the pull factors of unauthorized and undocumented immigration, the availability of jobs under those conditions that I explained. Mm-hmm. Because as I said, once you cross the border, once you cross the checkpoint and you are in the United States, somebody is going to hire you. And that's where things have not been solved. There have been a number of proposals to fix this broken immigration system. What I explained reflects a system of immigration and now asylum system that are, both are broken, right? Because the asylum system is being utilized as a way to facilitate that mobility as well.
It used to be, you go back years ago, it was Mexican males were the predominant migrant population, we'll say, trying to gain access to America. Now what you're saying, it's people from all over the world in this push-pull system, right? Mm-hmm. And so when we focus on Mexico and U.S.-Mexico relations, because that's a big part of your pedigree, and how important that is to be good neighbors and to be cooperative neighbors, yet this issue seems to be getting in the way, and it seems to be identified still more as a Mexican-American issue than it is an American, the rest of the world issue.
It is America, the rest of the world issue, because now we are seeing people trying to make it to the United States, crossing the Darien Gap, arriving to countries like Ecuador or Nicaragua. And after that, they are trying to make their way to the United States. A number of political refugees and people searching for a better life in Venezuela, for example, you know, they are willing to take this very dangerous journey to the United States, crossing the Darien Gap and being subject to robberies and to crimes of all kinds. It's not just Mexico-U.S. thing, not just something that needs to be, we need to focus all the resources on the border. This right. needs to be solved with a multidimensional approach that recognizes the pull and push factors, the root causes of unauthorized immigration, the inequalities, and you know, the solution should include not just the fix of U.S. immigration policy, but also collaboration with the sending countries.
There is a lot of press and media, of course, that's focused on of all these people gaining illegal entry into America. If even just the smallest of fraction have incredibly evil intent, this isn't just criminal intent. These are people that are looking to potentially blow up things. How do we fix that? Because if even 0.1% of those coming into this country illegally are oriented that way,
right,
that's dangerous.
We're all waiting for terrorists coming from Mexico, and usually terrorists come from where they are not expected. There are no strong reasons to believe that this is going to happen tomorrow. Of course, this can happen. There is always a possibility of that happening. But why focusing only on that when we need to solve also the root causes of this? We're focusing on, okay, let's build a wall. Let's put more people guarding the border. The solution is not to focus on the border. The solution is to solving the whole thing from a multidimensional approach.
So the human heart feels most deeply for children who are a part of this, right? So I want to play you a clip which has been played thousands of times over from various sources that say the same thing about where are the children.
Record numbers of migrants continue to pour across the U.S.-Mexico border. Many are children, and many of them are alone. The Biden administration puts them in homes with sponsors, but then what happens next?
700,000 migrant children have come into this country unaccompanied and alone.
Right.
How concerned are you, Professor, about these children?
Unaccompanied minors, they are accompanied by smugglers, and they become an option for families to work. Because of the lack of legal pathways for unauthorized immigration, sometimes unaccompanied minors are a source for the families to get this income. Most of the unaccompanied minors come with a smuggler, with a coyote. They enter the country. They are processed into the country. They, at some point, you know, for a very short time, are under the care of the U.S. government, the Health and Human Services. And then they are channeled to go with their sponsor. We don't know after that what happens, who the sponsor is, where they are going to be working. But there are a number of stories, news stories, about labor exploitation. And what about sexual exploitation? And they end up being exploited to an extent that we can think of modern-day slavery, which is kind of the basic concept of human trafficking. I have interviewed hundreds of migrants, and some of them already have a job. Many of them have a job already in the United
States. Already lined up before they
absolutely
come in.
Absolutely, yes. Absolutely. They're not just coming. I mean, the coyotes ask for a lot of money, and the families have to pay incredible amount of money.
How much money are we talking about?
The fees can go from $6,000 to even like $14,000 or $12,000.
For people that have meager resources, that's like everything and then some.
Everything, and they continue paying this debt. They come to this country with a debt, and they are trapped in this country. They need to be living with several other people, 20 people in one apartment, or just in the living room of another house, renting just the space because of that. And with regards to minors, we don't know where they end up. You know, they disappear. And like news stories tell us about how, like, for example, they end up working in Fruit of the Loom or Frito-Lay, and their lungs, their hands get damaged because of the very terrible labor conditions in this country. But they already have a job before they even enter the country.
To live on the border is a different experience than living, no offense to the people in Topeka, Kansas, right? You not only lived on the border, you collected stories, you collected the accounts. Tell me something about your most memorable experience and what you've written about that amplifies something that we don't understand or have never even thought about.
When people in this country think of the border, they have never been to the border. They just think about, this is a dangerous place where dangerous people can enter. I mean, and this is a place that I don't want to be at. The border is beautiful. And the border is very diverse in the sceneries, the demographics. You know, you cannot describe the place. There are multiple borders at the U.S.-Mexico border. And also the differences between Mexico and the U.S. I've crossed the whole U.S.-Mexico border 3 times and wrote a book on that. And the border is beautiful. It's a place where people have their own culture. They have their songs. They have their food. And this is like a third country. Many people speak Spanglish. Many people eat things that combine combining these two cultures, right? It's a third country. It's beautiful. It's different. It's not just about immigration, poverty, violence, drug trafficking. It's not like that.
It's about a melding of cultures.
It's a melding of cultures, bicultural, bilingual, binational. These are the three aspects that kind of defined who live at the border. And like Alan Bernstein said, el tercer país, the third country. And I adapted that concept. So what are the most memorable times of my life there? And I had a problem thinking about those because every single moment is memorable. Just sitting and talking with your best friend with a margarita in the hand, because margaritas were invented at the border. I didn't know that.
Nothing wrong with that, by the way.
Yeah, no, nothing wrong about right. that. But there's another place that it's magic. It's the Big Bend. And, you know, this national park, like, you know, with a lot of rocks, but it's beautiful, right? It's beyond like anything else. And our friends at the border, I lived in Brownsville and I crossed to Matamoros and, you know, I went to eat to the other side of the border and I still own an apartment, a condo in Brownsville. And it's 10 minutes walking from my condo to my favorite restaurant in Matamoros.
So not surprisingly, the whole issue of illegal immigration, U.S.-Mexico relations, the smuggling, the human trafficking has become embroiled in politics. I want to play you a clip. It was from a speech that the former president, Donald Trump, made a number of months ago. It really kind of speaks to, I would argue, would be the majority of Americans in terms of their perception of where things are today.
3 years ago, we had the most secure border in U.S. history. We built 561 miles of border wall. We got Mexico to give us free of charge 28,000 soldiers. Thank you very much. We ended catch and release. We let our great ICE agents do their job. And we deported over 1 million illegals in my very first term. 1 million. Back to their country.
There is a perception in this country that when it comes to legal immigration on the southern border, those are the two pieces, mm-hmm. that it's out of control. That if for some reason, whatever it was under former President Trump, today it's far worse. It feels like more of a direct threat that all of America is kind of feeling, as opposed to, again, just the border communities. Why is that? Why is there that perception? And then the second part of the question becomes the difficult part. What do we do about it?
What Donald Trump just said is not necessarily accurate. Of course, there is the perception based on the reality that things are getting worse. I don't know to what extent, but what he was saying is that the border was safest when he was president. I don't know if he remembers the time of the migrant caravans and, you know, a number of events during his presidency. Of course, you know, now we have people from all over the world trying to make it to the United States because we have not addressed the issue. He was a deporter in chief, but also Barack Obama was another deporter in chief and he deported more people than Donald Trump. Did that solve the situation? No. And during Barack Obama administration, many of the policies that were implemented in the Trump years and are implemented today, it's just like, it's very similar, focusing on the border and not solving this situation comprehensively, using a multidimensional approach. And there have been efforts that are bipartisan to have a deal, not this latest deal that, you know, it was an exchange of border security for money to continue in world conflicts and armed conflicts. No. It's fixing the broken immigration system at its core, which is comprehensive immigration reform. And when I wrote the paper that you mentioned about dismantling human smuggling networks mm-hmm. for the Kennedy School at Harvard, I talked about that, the root causes, the collaboration with other countries, and a whole of the government approach. Like the different agencies in the United States also need to be coordinated, and we need to collaborate and coordinate with the sending countries. You know, this is a situation that's not going to be solved by putting people boots on the ground or placing a border. And Donald Trump, in this address, was not saying that the situation was worse than in the Obama years and worse than in the Clinton years. Mm-hmm. I mean, worse than in the Bush years. You know, this has become worse because there is a fundamental problem that has not been solved. The immigration system of the United States is broken, and the relationships have made the life of the people worse and have increased the inequalities between the global North and the global South. We have to solve everything.
Shouldn't immigration itself not be just put under other headings? It should maybe be its own thing because it has such a massive impact on this country in terms of the economy, in terms of its security. We should review kind of how we're structured organization in this country to go at it with everything we've got.
You know, the secret here is in the implementation of a comprehensive plan to deal with this issue. And though you can have this czar or this ministry or this entity that would coordinate the efforts of other agencies and the whole thing, right? The coordination also with other countries and all that. I don't think it's a bad idea, but we need to have a real diagnosis of the things. Because if we think that everything is going to be solved by building a wall, we're not going to address the things. If we're going to focus on the border, we're going to do what we have been doing since 1994. So it doesn't help if we have the immigration czar or whatever, or we have this new immigration entity, if we are not really solving this in a comprehensive way.
We have to do it in stereo.
Exactly.
Right, okay.
That's right.
Okay. Now it's time for the book corner. So you have a relatively new book, yeah. Frontera. Tell me what the key takeaways are from that and why that's something that policymakers really should pay attention to.
Just a couple of weeks ago, our book was published, Frontera, A Journey Across the U.S.-Mexico Border. It's basically a book that describes the whole U.S.-Mexico border on both sides. We describe, you know, the history of those regions and each of the municipalities, what they represent, what are the main problems, what are the main virtues, where to eat, what to do, what songs, which, you know, famous people were born there. It's a book about the border.
So in other words, it's the other part of the story we're not getting because we're so focused
on immigration,
on the nightly newscast saying another 1,000 people just crashed the fence.
Absolutely. I mean, we talk about that, too. Because, of course, we cannot just ignore things about, you know, the presence of crime groups on the Mexican side connected with some, you know, corrupt authorities on the U.S. side of the border, certain parts of history that we need to acknowledge and history of the border. So the book is a comprehensive book on the border on both sides. And this started with a journey along the whole U.S.-Mexico border in 2013. And we did two more trips along the border, along the whole U.S.-Mexico border. But myself and my co-author, Sergio Chapa, I was a professor at the University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, and he was working for the local TV, Channel 4 in Harlingen, Texas. He was born and raised at the border, and I was born and raised in Mexico, but I lived at the border. We think of ourselves as borderlanders still, and we continue doing our trip. We're going to do like a book launch at different parts of the border, so we're going to start a new journey along the U.S.-Mexico border. This is about the border that is beyond what we see in the news. And I would recommend everybody to read it because it gives a taste of every single corner, every single like space along the U.S.-Mexico border.
I really believe strongly in wisdom comes from knowledge. And the more we know about this situation, the better. And I encourage everyone that's seeing this and listening to us to read the books, to read your papers, and then go beyond that. Because I think the answer we're all looking for is not a simplistic one, but one that's going to require a more comprehensive approach, which begins with really getting it. And you're one of those people that I think is allowing for the rest of us to kind of get it.
Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you, Adam.
Remember to subscribe today and hit the bell so you never miss another episode of the show with that trademark opener from Washington, D.C. It's 13th and Park.